This is Brandon Boat with the Theater of Public Policy. Our guest today is John McTaggart, who is the Chief Executive Officer of American Public Media Group, which is the parent company of Minnesota Public Radio, American Public Media, Southern California Public Radio in Los Angeles, and Classic South Florida in Miami. Mr. McTaggart has been in public radio for a number of years. He started as the NPR station manager in Bemidji, literally building it with solder and soldering irons and constructing it all. He's also an alum of Bemidji State University, and we talked with Mr. McTaggart about a lot of different things, including how he got his start, what makes Minnesota Public Radio unique, and where they see the station going in the next 50 years. What does the future hold, and how are they going to try and reach different organizations, different people, and keep up with the kind of growing diversity of Minnesota? I hope you enjoy the show.
All right. So thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I'm very excited. So there's so many things that I want to talk about. And I should say in the second part of the show, we're going to turn it over to all of you. So start thinking about questions you might want to ask. But I almost wanted to start with a big, gigantic picture in the sense of Minnesota, I think a lot of people realize, is somewhat special in the kind of public media that we have. People who have driven through other states by accident, I'm sure, are like, what happened? Why is our public media, what happened to it? Why is the radio so lousy now? Because they weren't listening to one of the other stations that public radio owns. So why is Minnesota a state that has had this strong tradition of public radio in a way that other places may not have?
Well, I get asked that question often because there is a remarkable difference. And this is my own opinion, but I think it's because in Minnesota we have more optimists.
Really?
Yeah, I think so.
Have you met Minnesotans?
Yeah, I mean, you know, optimists are curious. And optimists believe, sometimes against all apparent evidence, that we can make things better. And set out to do it. I mean, that's been my experience.
So there's people who just constantly think, we can make this public radio station better.
Yeah,
like,
we'll
just keep giving money and it'll get
better
eventually.
Sure. Or we can make the community better. Or we can make the state better. And some things we do, whether it's music or whether it's information, helps in that. Or it connects to a part of how curious people, optimistic people, believe in and try to make things better for their neighbor.
This actually brings me to another thing I wanted to ask about. Minnesota Public Radio, I think a lot of people know, started at St. John's University, and it was... Okay, so the St. John's graduate is here. It started off in somewhat of a ragtag way of trying to figure out what it is, and it's gone through a lot of evolution over time, and I almost have a hard time explaining to people when I was talking to them about this show, what is Minnesota Public Radio at this point? It's a lot of so many different things. It's classical music, it's the current, it's news, it's online, it's live events, it's what isn't it, maybe is an easier question.
I'm not even going to try the what isn't it. If the question is, how did it get to be this?
Sure, that sounds like a good question that I would have asked.
It was opportunism, but it was also a belief that if we could create, even in 1967, there was a belief at St. John's by a couple students and the then president of St. John's, Father Coleman Berry, that if we could create something interesting, something delightful, something valuable, using the technology that was available, and ask the people who used it to support it, either they would or they wouldn't. And if they did, then we would go a little further. And that's been pretty much every year for 40, now almost 8 years, that every year we commit to make the radio and all those things you mentioned as great as we can. And then we do that trusting that if we do it, and if you enjoy it, we'll ask you to support it, and each person makes a decision. Companies make decisions, but individuals make decisions and support it. And as that support has grown, the organization's been able to grow.
This is curious. We were talking a little before the show about your start with, you built the Bemidji station from the ground up, and you talked about how exciting that was. When we say you built it, You literally soldered things, correct?
Yeah. Yeah, that's how you do it.
That's how you build something. I've read that. But I'm curious because there's almost this pioneering aspect to the history of Minnesota Public Radio where it was folks just building a brand new station or something. Now it's this enormous organization that I think you said has stations in 9 different states and reaches almost 100,000 people, or no, almost 1 million people in Minnesota every week, correct? Right. And so I wonder, do you lose some of that sort of entrepreneurial pioneering spirit that started it?
Oh, I hope not. I mean, it's certainly, there's an expectation, or maybe let's call it an aspiration. And we tend to, our organization tends to attract people who have, I don't know if I'd call it a pioneering spirit. It's probably the best way to describe the earlier days because it hadn't been done. There wasn't a model for it. There wasn't a textbook on it. So when it was all brand new. But just because we're larger doesn't mean that we have a different DNA. The organization still exists by believing, and there are people here, and certainly you know staff members, who believe that we can do more than we did before. And whether that's more events, whether it's more service on social media, certainly whether it's more radio, we've taken that approach to the growth. Now, some of that's been opportunistic, but deciding where you want to be opportunistic, that's pretty much the strategic plan we've had, which is, you know, we think we can create more value, public service media value, using the tools that are available to us and earning the trust and support of our audience, then that's going to be good for the state and it's going to be good for our audience. But every move we've made, every opportunity we've taken advantage of has started with, is the audience going to like this? Is there going to be additional service for people who want to listen or people who want to attend? And generally, we've been right. Not always, but generally.
It's so curious. I listened to an interview that you did during an Ask the President segment, and you were asked a question about this, like the balance in the newsroom between what people are talking about or what people like and what they need to know, which is obviously like the oldest debate that happens, I imagine, in newsrooms. But I've got to think that it's particularly challenging in a situation where you have a membership model, where people feel a special connection in some ways to Minnesota Public Radio. It's not just, oh, I'm a passive listener. I'm a member. I feel some sense of ownership over it. And I'm curious how you then sort of play out that kind of a relationship. What do you do with that?
Well, this may be too basic to answer
please,
the question.
Please, nothing's too basic
I
for
mean,
me.
It may be too simplistic to answer the question fully. But, you know, there's two things that we do as an organization. We inform and we inspire. Those are the things that really are the work that we do. Now, we do it in a lot of different ways. We use a lot of different tools. But on the information side, which is from a news perspective, I think it's a critical time in America, certainly a critical time in our communities. There's a lot of complex stuff that we're dealing with. And we believe that if people are better informed, they can make better decisions about their community, about their profession, about their relationships. So it starts with a commitment to editorially independent and fact-based information. Unfortunately, but I think realistically, those organizations like us, and we're not the only ones, that are committed to editorially independent and facts that inform the noise in the community, the noise in the country for information organizations that are not committed to those things is really loud. I mean, sensationalism, selective choice of facts to sort of twist something toward your own point of view, and we're just not doing that.
I was going to ask, why you're fighting a losing battle here. I mean, haven't you ever thought about just having, you know, the dirty 30 every, like, half hour or something?
I think it depends on what battle you're trying to win, right? We believe, this is going to sound corny, but we really do believe in an informed democracy. We actually have Thomas Jefferson's quote in the bathrooms at Minnesota Public Radio.
That where they belong. But you're right. There is a lot of that sensationalism and a lot of that kind of news out there. But then I've also got imagined in talking to folks that there's just a perception that is how all news is. And whether or not we say it's fact-based or not, I mean, obviously, public radio has a perception. People think of it in a particular way. And I wonder if that matters or if that's something that you try and combat or do something about, or if you say, no, it's just the facts and let people make up their minds one way or the other.
Well, I believe that if I believe you earn the reputation you have, and so the perception is earned by something we've done. But when it comes to something specific, a news story or a particular issue that someone felt we were too hard or too soft on, I say bring on the scrutiny. Really examine it. We'll show you the sources that we used. We'll ask you to show us your sources. Let's find out. We're really not interested in proving a point of view.
Mm-hmm.
We're interested in making sure that as many facts as we can gather, that are really facts, are available to as many people as possible. And if we've not done it well, then tell us, because we want to make it better.
There is a public radio like perception, right? There's a stereotype of who what public radio is, or is. And now I just want to ask if you'll say it, like, or what you think it is, sort of like.
I'm not sure what you want me to say. But
no, I'm curious. I'm just very curious about like.
Well, that's the word. Curious. I think people that listen to public media are curious, and that's who we're committed to serving. I mean, that cuts across any stereotype you can make. Are you curious? Do you want to know more? If you stop being curious, we're all relatively curious. There's a little bit of curiosity. There's a lot of curiosity. But somewhere along that continuum is the public media audience, and I think it's closer to a lot of curiosity than less curiosity. Historically, public media largely served people who are educated.
Mm-hmm.
Because two-thirds of public broadcasting still exists or is still owned and operated by a college or a university or a local school district. And public broadcasting kind of grew up on college and university campuses. But as it has grown up, and as audiences of every socioeconomic stripe, educational stripe, every worldview, political view, ethnicity, age group, what we're finding is the common thread and the most identifiable thread for the public radio audience, public media audience generally, is curiosity.
Yeah, listening to one of the Ask the President segments you did, I was surprised there were multiple people who called in and said, oh, I feel like it's actually not, Minnesota Public Radio isn't as brainy as it used to be, or it's not as highbrow or educated as it used to be, which, whether that's true or not, I find it interesting that that was the piece that people were really holding on to. And I am curious, is that a perception that you are happy with, or is it something that you want to make it broader?
I think being inclusive and accessible to more people is absolutely something we want to do. And to the extent that we have chosen hosts and chosen approaches and presentation methods, and whether it's in a live event or what's online or in our broadcast media, of course we want to be accessible. I don't buy the dumbing down. I think we have really smart people, and they will be critical and beat us up justifiably if we are not honoring their intelligence. At the same time, you don't have to be erudite and you don't have to be academic.
Can you spell that for me?
No, I can't. But I know what it means.
Good.
If a friend of mine, Craig Curtis, who's a program director, said no one in the history of radio has ever listened to the wrong radio station. And I think that's true. We get exactly the audience we deserve. And if we want to serve a broader audience, we have to be more accessible and more inclusive. And if you want to serve a really narrow audience, you can do that. And we've decided that, entrusted with a radio license, more Minnesotans and more Americans should be taking advantage of the public service. And that's not necessarily for everybody, but it is something we're working to broaden.
So I want to come back to actually a little bit of a technology question, in the sense that Minnesota Public Radio obviously has an app, more than one app. Why?
Big deal.
Why do you have more than one app?
More than one thing we want to do.
Okay, that's good. That's good. So you have more than one app. National Public Radio has multiple apps now. There's live streaming through iTunes. There's this fascinating new app. I actually very much recommend it, the Radio One app, or the NPR One, where it basically curates, almost Spotify-like, news stories based on where you are and things that you thumb up or thumbs down. My long-winded way to get to a question here is, it seems like this is a much harder job than it might have been 40 years ago, when it was like, is the radio on? Yes, the radio is on. Now you have to worry about multiple platforms and multiple types of services and being online, and I don't know. Do you want a time machine? I'm trying to figure out what would make...
Well, I don't want to go back.
No.
Absolutely not. I mean, in the time when it was simpler, if you will, that there was FM radio or AM radio before that, then the only way we had to serve people was an on-off switch, radio or not radio. Now we have so many different ways. I mean, every one of us probably has a favorite device in your pocket or purse. And if we're going to be relevant, we have to be there. The first time you want to access something or you have a question or you want to gain some sort of insight or be entertained, and we're not even part of the choices on your favorite device, we're irrelevant. And irrelevancy is actually not very attractive in the long term.
No.
So
I keep telling everybody that about me. I don't want to be irrelevant. Yeah.
So if you're going to be relevant, the audience has already voted. The people that we're serving, the community's already voted. They want to use multiple devices. They want to listen when they want to listen, not when we want to put it on the air. They want to be able to manipulate it. They want to be able to respond to it. They want to ask questions about it. They want to tell us what they thought about it. And so we think the technology is actually a tremendous advantage now. More complicated, certainly, but full of much more opportunity than we've had. We can serve many more Minnesotans and many more Americans using many more devices and technology than if we were left with only FM or only any one of the technologies. So we think it's an opportunity.
So I want to, we're just about out of time in this first part, but I did want to ask a couple questions about you and your role. You took over for Bill Kling, who was the founder, one of the founders of Minnesota Public Radio. He was there for 41 years?
44
years. And that is a very rare thing to take over for somebody who has been in a place for 44. Did you have to, like, drag him out of his chair, like, that he would...
No, not at all.
No. Good. So he was like, you can have it. Like, I'm just curious about what the transfer is like in something like that.
Bill's a friend and a mentor of mine. And I said, you know, Bill, 44 years, that's a great start. Let's see what we can do.
That's good. And so what do you have him doing right now? Soldering wire on the roof? Or?
No, although if he wanted to, I'm sure he would. No, Bill, for a time, and continues to be involved in public media, as a volunteer and informally, having been involved with Minnesota Public Radio as the founder and for 44 years, there's some things, including institutional memory, that the best phone call or the most efficient way to get the information is just to ask him. But he's interested in a number of things in public media and still does them. And, you know, he and I have stayed in touch and continue to, you know, from time to time have lunch.
And so the bigger question, I guess, going forward then is you took over this very large and established media organization, and you're at the helm now. What does success, I guess, look like for you personally? You know, if you were to, if at some point in 44 years, retire and then continue to serve soldering wire, but in that time, what would be success? What would you look at and you would say, I did this, and that means that I did a good job with it?
Well, I am a true believer in what we do. I believe that it creates value for people, and I validated every day by the fact that people listen and people support. But for me personally, the fact that I get to work with really talented people, people who on most things are so much smarter than I am and they challenge me, the fact that I get to work for a cause that matters to me, I do believe that the better informed we are, the better we are able to govern ourselves. I believe in inspiring communities. I believe in great art. And Minnesota Public Radio gives me an opportunity to be involved in all of that on a daily basis. But the one thing, and I decided this a long time ago, God willing, if I could work with people in my respect and do something that mattered to me, that's not really work. And I get to do that every day.
Ladies and gentlemen, on that amazing note, John McTaggart. Okay, if you have a question, please just raise your hand and good, the man in the hardest place get. Okay, so I'll come up there and I'll come around and it'll be good and it's good exercise and I trust you.
Thank you. Okay, for one, thank you for being here, but two, what does Arianite actually mean?
What does erudite mean?
Somebody Google it, will you?
Okay, off to a solid start. Other questions? Other questions? I'm looking for hands. I'll come down in the front. Sorry. I'm coming. Here. Yes, ma'am.
What's the biggest threat to public radio?
What's the biggest threat to public radio?
Oh.
Sharks? You know, I don't know that I can speak for all of public radio on that. But I know that I think the greatest threat to our organization is that we will fail to create the place. I'm going to answer this seriously. We'll fail to create the place that really talented people who want to be involved in public service want to work. Because if we can be the place where really talented people who are committed to public service media want to do their best work, then all the other threats can be confronted. I don't think there's an existential threat, in other words. But I do think that in order to not just survive, but in order to do what our mission calls us to do, we have to be a place where really great people want to work.
How, if I can ask a follow-up to that, I mean, you've talked a lot about how important the people are to Minnesota Public Radio and this being a, how do you keep it like that? How do you keep it a place that the best people want to be?
Well, we tend to attract, and I don't know that I have an answer for it. I don't know if I can bottle that into a tweet.
If you could, that would be amazing.
I know. You know, you have to create a place where smoldering discontent is okay. You know, where people are never quite satisfied with even having done our very best work, because we could probably make it better next time, and still not make that a place where there's a lot of criticism or where there's a sense of lack of accomplishment. But really talented people want to work with really talented people. And the reason I can be really confident in the question or the answer to the question is anytime we have a chance for employees to get together and talk about what matters or why they love Minnesota Public Radio, why they love to work there, people's on the top of the list. The colleagues that you get to work with, the challenge from working with really talented people, the chance to be part of something where really talented people are doing something together. And we're not making widgets. We're creating experiences for people. So it really does come down to the people that do it.
Cool. Okay, other questions. I know that there were a few other hands, so I'll come there in the front. Come on back of the house here. You're going to let me down. All right, here we go.
So prior to tonight, I naively thought that most states had their own public radio, and now I realize that that's not the case. It sounds like NPR is broadcast maybe to 9 other states. So how many other states are there that have their own unique public radio stations, and are we the best?
The answer to the last question is yes, we're the best.
Take that, Arizona.
There are about 1,300 public radio stations in the country. There are a number of states that have networks that are organized in sort of a statewide system. We own and operate 51 stations in 9 states, largely because we've been invited to come to Los Angeles and operate a news station, or to Florida and operate a classical music station. In each of those communities, they have a board. In each of those communities, they have local service and local audience. So the fact that we're in 50 states is a little bit of an artifact of being invited to do this there. But we don't run state systems in any other place than Minnesota. So there's independent broadcasters in Minnesota. There's independent broadcasters in every state. And a few states have networks that would be organized sort of cooperatively. Or in Iowa, for example, it's a cooperation among the colleges and universities in Iowa. And I think there's 2 or 3 networks in Georgia, for example. But it's actually doesn't make a lot of sense. But it grew up that way.
Well, why doesn't it make a lot of sense?
If you've ever spent time on a college or a university campus and tried to figure out the administration or the academics, there are a lot of things that are done for the benefit of the student, not necessarily for the benefit of the college. Most of public broadcasting didn't happen because there was a strategic plan. Public broadcasting happened because there were people with ideas and passion and physics professors that could apply to the FCC and get an FM license before the university knew what they were doing. And you know, that's in the 60s and 50s, that's how it happened. And so there's a lot of things that, you know, I think the current reality reflects more how it started than any master plan that was intended to create it.
Okay. Oh, here and then up there. So I'm sorry, this row, I'm going to lean over you.
Are there any other markets who have come to our strong public media market to ask advice or consultancy?
In fact, 10 years ago, we started The Current. And we started The Current on a belief that we could invest in a music community and it would be more than a radio station. It would actually be an investment in a vibrant local music scene. And that's really what gave rise to The Current. And while we feel good about what we're contributing to the music scene in Minnesota, there's a number of communities now around the country that have said, we want to make a similar investment in our local music community. How do we do that? And so we'll get a call, not necessarily every month, but certainly a number of times a year. I'll take a call, or Jim McGuinn from The Current will take a call, and each of us will offer whatever advice we have, not because we're experts, but just to share the experience that we've had. And that's an example.
Okay, there was a hand over here. Everyone in the middle wants to ask.
You guys are coming up on a 50-year anniversary. Where do you go from here? You've spoken a little bit about technology. How do you make it another 50 years?
The glib answer, we go to 100, right? But I think the honest answer is when we put the interest of the audience first and become smarter at what audiences are telling us by their behavior, not just by their comments, and we pay attention to how people are behaving. 10 years ago, Facebook didn't exist. The iPhone didn't exist. The iPad didn't exist. Twitter didn't exist. That's 10 years ago. When you're speaking in 50-year terms, how do you plan for 50 years when 10 years ago I didn't imagine any of those things happening, and now 41% of our digital audience comes from a mobile device. 3 years ago, that was 5%. That's how fast it's changing. And that's just all of us in doing what we normally want to do. So what we are investing in is really the capability to constantly change, which is going to be a really important change for the organization. Rather than investing in how stable we can be for 50 years, how can we invest both in a technology platform, not get too excited about any one technology, but commit ourselves to be really agile, and whatever technology you all want to use, we need to be prepared to try to serve you in that way. That's new. That's relatively new as a culture and as a demand. So investing in the capacity to change constantly, because change is constant. And we can't win by technology. Part of the other preparation is hiring people who have different skills than we have already, and making sure that the folks who are in the organization look more, act more, and are spending more time with the audiences that are growing up than the audiences that might have existed for us 30 or 40 years ago.
Okay, I've actually got two hands over here, I think so.
I have two hands. At the beginning of the show, you answered a question about the population of your listeners. You defined them as curious, which I thought was a great answer. I'm curious if... I didn't mean to use the word curious. But I am curious as to, do you see a need of developing your population of listeners to be more racially and ethnically diverse? And if you do see that need, how do you think you might get there or strategically approach that?
The answer to the first part of the question is absolutely yes. And the reason why we think that our future audience will be and should be more ethnic diverse, more socioeconomically diverse, is really a fundamental of excellence and growth. We can't be as good as we want to be if we continue to serve only one segment of the population. And to serve a broader part of the population, it's actually just a statistical fact. As we serve more, it will be more diverse. It has to be. As I said in part of the earlier question, it is not our vision, nor is it our imperative. Certainly our mission, while it doesn't require that we are big, it does require that we're relevant. And we are not as relevant as we want to be to as many Minnesotans or as many as Americans as we think we can be. That requires some changes. It doesn't require a, you know, left-hand turn or a right-hand turn, but it does require an intentionality about how people want to be involved with us, live events, certain technology platforms, on the radio. We now have more tools to serve more parts of Minnesota and more parts of America than we did before. And we need to be really intentional about that. We don't have quotas or targets for certain, you know, segments of the population. But if we want to grow and we want to, and our mission, we want our mission to serve as many people as possible, we will have to be able to serve more ethnically, socioeconomically, age diverse people than we are now. And everyone in the organization knows that and senses that, and we've set goals to do it, and we're eager to hear suggestions on how we can do it better, but absolutely it's a goal.
Did you have a hand as well? Yeah.
So I first off wanted to start by saying thank you for just providing a news source that's more neutral and more balanced and balanced in facts, because I feel like a lot of the news sources today are very skewed and have a lot of investment in them that are not necessarily coming from a news source or from a source of like neutral development. So I just want to start off by saying that. But my question is more around the lines of sort of building off of this gentleman's question around, like, are there things that, because I feel like your company's value proposition, and I'm coming from sort of a marketing lens, is almost like a neutral news source or something that's more fact-based, more something like a CNN. Is there something that you guys are thinking in terms of, like, medium development that's outside of app, like, mobile application development, or even, like, more along the lines of TV or things like that that you're trying to think about in terms of broadening your reach?
I'll answer the question, and by answering it may betray that I missed the question specifically, so hold me accountable, but we are not really in the radio business right now. We're in the great listening business. And I say that as a matter of specifics, because we actually don't care how you listen and what you listen on from a technology standpoint. We're all about creating a listening experience when it comes to our basics. But we also know that if all we're going to do is create great listening, we're missing very large segments of the population who don't have either a preference for listening. They have a preference for reading or for watching or for experiencing or for attending. So we are very intentionally broadening, to use your word, the ways in which we tell stories, the way in which we accomplish our mission. Younger audiences are much more visual, just as a generalization. I have two daughters and three grandkids. My oldest daughter is 31, and when I was moving her from college into her first apartment, I discovered she didn't own a radio. Okay. But the first thing she did when we got everything into the apartment is she plugged in her laptop and put her earbuds in her laptop. And I thought, okay, well, there's what I really need to pay attention to. It's not about the device. It's not about FM. It's about listening. I have a 14-year-old daughter as well. And she spends a lot of time listening, but at the same time watching. She's always on her small screen. You know, you don't have to be really smart to just pay attention to that and say, if we want to be relevant, we're going to have to develop visual skills. We're going to have to develop skills, of ways to tell stories that are not only radio or only listening. And we're doing that. We're investing in, we had over, 2 million video downloads last month. Wow. That's Minnesota Public Radio. Now, a lot of them were the music sessions for The Current in our studio. But still, we put cameras there, and we have people who are cutting and editing, and we're posting it in a way that can still be serving folks who would rather watch it than just listen to it. Did I get the question? Okay.
And as a quick follow, one of the things I wanted to ask you about was podcasts, because that also seems an area that has popped up over the last 10 years, and that I know Minnesota Public Radio has been investing a lot in developing a handful of podcasts. And I guess the question is, how do you think about those differently, or as just part of a larger pie, or how do you fit them into what Minnesota Public Radio is?
Well, podcasts, like a number of other things, give us opportunities to bring voices to audiences that we couldn't bring otherwise. So someone has something to say, but they're not going to do it 1 hour once a week, or they're not going to do it every day, or they're not a radio show, or they're not a stage show. Podcasts give us an opportunity to be very intentional about trying new topics and trying new talent in a way that doesn't require, you know, all of the infrastructure that some of the other technology requires. Podcasts, you may all have them. Or those of you who listen to them have your favorites. You can also develop a very loyal audience of 4,000 or 5,000 people. You probably wouldn't build a radio station or commit an entire radio station to 3,000 or 4,000 people. It's not what radio's great at. So I think the answer for us is we're experimenting with podcasts. We have some podcasts that are very popular. We have some podcasts that are downloaded by a couple thousand people. And we'll be responsive to what audiences love, and we'll try to, you know, keep inviting people who have creative ideas to come and work with us on that. I think the verdict's out on podcasts long term. Mm-hmm. Everyone loves to talk about the hits. But like so much in the media business, it's a hits business.
Yeah.
You know, Serial was really popular, and it was a hit. Quick, name another one that's popular. So we're
can, but yes.
And if you listen to a lot of podcasts, you can.
Yeah.
But there's the rub. Not everybody does.
Somebody told me 3 years ago, oh, isn't this whole podcast thing over? So I do definitely.
Yeah, we look at it this way. We were providing on-demand listening long before anyone else was. We put Garrison Keillor's monologues on cassette tapes and mailed them to people before podcast was even invented.
Wow.
So, you know, we know what it is to find audio that's fantastic and put it in a format that people really want and that they can use and that they can purchase and they can use on their own time. And we're going to continue to do that. The technology has now allowed us to do it in many more ways, but being responsive to that need or that desire in the audience is something that we've been doing for decades.
So it's a sort of wrap-up question here, and we've kind of gotten to this a little bit with some of the other questions, but somebody asked you about 50 years down the road, which I entirely understand is a long time to look, but if we're just watching Minnesota Public Radio and American Public Media for the next several years, you know, what are the things that what are you cooking up in your X-Labs in the back that are going to be the things that we're, you know, glued to or excited about in the years ahead? Is it more storytelling? Is it different ways of getting that storytelling out? Is it events? Where's your energy and passion right now?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Matt.
Not to be too glib about it, everything you said is true. And rather than just say, well, it's more of everything, we are being pretty intentional, and I think inviting the creativity of the people who tell stories. We're storytellers, sense makers. So I can get excited about one of our reporters wanting to experiment with GoPro. Okay, a radio reporter who wants to go and tell stories about the Twin Cities Roller Derby Club using a GoPro camera instead of just a microphone.
What is the insurance cost on that?
But
jeez,
it's cool. Or to tell us a story about how the giraffes at Como Zoo eat by showing you, you know, by telling that story using a GoPro camera instead of just a microphone. I mean, that doesn't sound like deep innovation, but it's immediately shareable. It's something that we haven't done previously. And I've got a list of those ideas, and frankly, we're constantly soliciting them, both formally and informally, from people inside the organization to say, what's your interesting, wacky idea that we can try for a while? We have innovation fellowships inside the organization for people to take up to 90 days and stop their regular job and go try this thing that's kind of connected to what the future might look like. You know, if we had all night, I could share some really interesting and fascinating ideas, half of which probably won't come of anything. But we are constantly looking for more creative ways to excite people or to inform people or to have people understand something that's complicated, but as you understand it, it actually allows you to make a better decision about something.
Ladies and gentlemen, a big round of applause for Mr. John McTaggart. There's a
Thank you for listening. Our show was recorded live at the Bryant Lake Bowl in Minneapolis. If you'd like to see us in person, you can find our schedule by going to www.t2p2.net or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Thanks.